Thank you, everybody. And Ian, I think you may need to stop sharing if I'm going to share my screen in a sec. It's good to be back with you all. Before we get into the sermon, let me say that I have particularly appreciated having met and worshipped with you a few years ago. These days, I live in Singapore and I work with various denominations connected to the Council for World Mission in more than 40 countries. And therefore, I have a lot of meetings and devotional times online. And your disciplined and faithful practice has informed and influenced me greatly. So thank you so much for that and for staying faithful. Now, let me just share screen. And I'm going to do it the advanced way, which is a little bit trickier, so bear with me. Okay. So in today's readings, the theme of water stood out for me. Where can we find water in the wilderness? The Israelites complained to Moses. Even slavery is better than dying of thirst. And a woman said to Jesus, "Sir, you have no bucket and the well is deep. Where do you get living water?" Both scenes are a bit dramatic. They move from the ordinary to the miraculous, from the secular to the spiritual. Both stories play with symbolism. Where there is water, there is life. I love the storytelling in both of these. We may as well be in Egypt. You've brought us to a place of death. And you have no bucket. It's kind of classic. I wanted to highlight for you the word dam. Not dam as in we know it, storing up water and stopping a river. The word dam in Hebrew means liquid life. In Deuteronomy, the dam is the life, or the water of life is the dam is life. Sometimes the word dam is translated as blood, but it's more than that. The word is found within the related words of Adam, Adam, human, and Adama, meaning ground. Adama is the ground, and from the ground, the human Adam is made. And when dam is outside the creature, it means death. Dam, or the water of life, is meant to be embodied to be life. And for some of this thinking, I'm indebted to the Bible Project, which you can find online. And if you find Bible Project, you can look up dam and it will give you a little video about the word. In the conversation between Jesus and the Samaritan woman, Jesus is the bucket. He is the embodiment of life. For people around the world of every age and environment, water is life. Access to drinkable water means possibility. It is ordinary, but it is also life. When I travel, I often say I come from the driest inhabited continent, where we learn to swim at an early age. As Aussies living in a land of bushfires, droughts and floods, beaches and deserts, we are aware of how precious water is. In outback and rural settings, we are mindful of the water tanks, even in urban areas, and we can face water restrictions, and we never leave a leaky tap for long. This week, we have seen images of Catherine and the Daly River. Water can be beautiful and terrible, sometimes both at the same time. Water is delicate and powerful. A small leak in the roof will find any crack or low passage. And waters come from above and from below. We need water to drink. We can also drown in it. We testify to discipleship in the act of baptism, being rebirthed in the water, dying and rising to new life. It is mundane, and it is sacred. When I'm in the field, moving well beyond the places where tourists go, I carry water filtration bottles. And in the Pacific, I see AusAid water tanks in many countries. In parts of Africa and Asia, I see wells and irrigation systems developed through partnerships with churches and aid agencies. Many of the other missionaries I travel with look for the mission schools and hospitals, but my first question is usually about water. With clean water, life can flourish. Without it, illness and poverty can dominate. Flowing water means it's more likely to be clean. Stagnant water can mean all sorts of diseases: cholera, typhoid, Zika, hepatitis A, mosquitoes and parasites, dengue fever, and malaria. I am 61 years young. Being an Aussie, I prefer to be called by my first name, Amelia. One of the programs I run is called the Training and Mission Program, which takes about a dozen young people from around the world each year. They come together for 6 months of formation to become globally aware mission-oriented people. And I have had to let them call me Auntie or Auntie Amelia rather than just Amelia. They feel uncomfortable calling me by my first name. They're used to calling older people Ma'am or Rev or Doctor, but not by a first name. At first, I still introduced myself by my first name, and then some of them explained. At 61, I am positively ancient. Most of them don't know people over 50, or if they do, they do not get to have conversations with them. Around the world, most developed nation leaders are over 55, but most majority world leaders are 10 to 15 years younger. A lot of my work is with churches developing people in their 20s and 30s to take up major leadership in their societies. So let's have a look at where Kiribati is. This is a world map, and when we're trying to explain Kiribati, we usually say, look at the very edge on each side, halfway down, on both sides of the map, you'll find Kiribati. It's on both sides. And people are surprised by that, and then we show them a picture of the Pacific. And you can see here that Kiribati is right in the middle, and where it says Tarawa, that's the capital of Kiribati, or Kiribati in writing, but Kiribati when we speak. And underneath in the middle is Tuvalu. Now, some of the young people that I work with come from places like Kiribati and Tuvalu in the middle of the vast Pacific. Both of these countries consist of multiple low-lying coral islands and ring islands or atolls, characterized by water scarcity. And when I'm in places like that, I'm reminded of Coleridge's poem, The Rime of the Ancient Mariner. The words, water, water everywhere, and not a drop to drink. Let's have a look first at Tuvalu. Fresh water in Tuvalu primarily relies on rainwater harvesting via roof catchments and storage tanks, supplemented by limited, often brackish groundwater. Due to the absence of rivers and streams, residents collect rain in household tanks. During severe droughts, desalination plants are used, and the government manages water rations to ensure supply. Well, actually, going back to Tuvalu for a moment, 80% of Tuvaluans have taken up the Australian offer to apply for climate migration visas for Australia. And you can see there roads inundated by water, the airstrip that goes down the middle of Tarawa forms actually the market and the cricket pitch and many other things during the day, and then it closes when the planes come into land and when they take off, and then it reopens again as the common road for everybody. And you can see the politician talking from the water as he's addressing the UN. Now, Kiribati has suffered the loss of most of its groundwater lenses. Now, a groundwater lens is a freshwater kind of lens bubble that floats on top of the salt water found beneath the surface of the atolls. Contamination from septic systems and over-extraction means that wells are often brackish, and Kiribati is increasingly dependent upon foreign-developed desalination plants, such as those provided by China. "The sea is his," says the psalmist. And so Pacific theologians ask the questions: when we build desalination plants, what happens to the salt and minerals? How does the balance of the ocean or Moana life change? What happens to the reefs and sea life when we alter the ocean? What happens when we do land reclamation in places like Singapore, building more and more concrete city where there were once mangroves and fish? The current Tuvaluan Minister for Home Affairs, Climate Change and the Environment is the Reverend Dr. Maina Talia. He did his PhD in Australia and moved from being a church minister to representing Tuvalu at COP and the UN. He is still preaching, but not just within the church. Part of the work of mission has been to decolonize mission. Well, what does that mean? Throughout the 18th, 19th, and 20th centuries, the attractiveness of mission for receivers of missionaries was that they would bring practical help to improve lives: education and healthcare, tending to people's needs. That opened up conversations that have seen spiritual and physical engagement go hand in hand. However, the flip side to that strategy was that the gifts of love were not made unconditionally. In many parts of the world, receiving the gospel and its political and economic influences were conditions to receive aid. Missionaries were sponsored by people who also wanted economic and power control over nations, leading to forms of colonization that meant the disappearance of language, culture, and independence. Land acquisition became more important than the life flourishing of God's creatures in God's creation. What we see now in many countries that were missioned and colonized is a history of subjugation and oppression of indigenous peoples and the migration of non-traditional landowners who took the wealth back to the colonized nations, building their own economies. This has led to mission themes of justice and reparations, such as the Legacies of Slavery movement that seeks to renew life in places and communities that were impacted by the transatlantic slave trade. More than 1 million people slaved. When the woman at the well talks with Jesus about worshipping on the mountain or in Jerusalem, we hear an ancient story of how religion has sometimes been coerced by where power is located. The mountain represents the northern kingdom, and Jerusalem represented the southern seat of power. Access to holy places can be dominated by powers. But Jesus talks of situating worship in spirit and in truth, not just in place or historic identity. This is a stretching, a bit like you, not placing worship in a building, but in many simultaneous places and even in different time zones. So, how do we get to the point of stretching how we live faithful lives? Let me tell you about four young women: Ta'abe, Waina, Rike, and Tatai. Ta'abe is in the pink, is a young woman who did a World Communion of Reformed Churches internship in Germany before coming on the Council for World Mission Training and Mission Program for 6 months in the Philippines and Jamaica. And this picture shows her transiting through London. She now has a diploma in mission and a diploma in ministry. Her goal is to be a global leader for Kiribati people as they get their story into the world. In the middle, Ricky and Tatai, pictured here dancing for people in the Presbyterian Church of Wales, are both women pastors working in congregations in Kiribati. Ricky is also the presbytery chairperson, and Tatai is recently ordained. Usually in Kiribati, the women get a better education than the men, because if the weather is good, the boys will skip school and go fishing. So Ricky is committed to staying in Kiribati while there is still land to be tended. Oh, sorry, Tatai is committed to staying there while there is still land to be tended, and Ricky is committed to staying in Kiribati while there are still people who need pastoring. Both regard that as their spiritual calling. And the girl on the right with the headdress is Waina. She's currently doing a PhD in mission history at the Pacific Communities University in Suva in Fiji. And why would we sponsor a very expensive PhD in history when the current and future needs are so great? Well, Waina is trying to write her nation's history while Kiribati is still there. For those who migrate, her writing may be the record of their identity, possibly the only written record by a Kiribati person rather than outside anthropologists' observations. She is under pressure to record the stories of the Kiribati people before their country disappears. One of the obstacles that prevented this kind of work in the past was the idea from simplistic missionary Sunday school lessons that taught that the rainbow tells us that God will never send another flood. So God will save us and we do not need to fear the ocean rising. We've had to work painstakingly with pastors and students to reframe the understanding that sea level rise is not from God, but from the sin of humanity. And with that in mind, Tuvaluans have already planned for mass migration, and Kiribati people are starting to see what is likely to be in store for them. To buy time for migrations, mitigation programs are part of today's mission work for the churches. Coral planting on the left and mangrove planting on the right. Participating in planting the corals and mangroves in the Pacific Oceans around some of the most at-risk islands brings home the reality of climate crisis to people who come from urban and rural areas from other parts of the world. So how does a changing view of water impact people in other places? Well, context changes everything. How water is experienced in the desert is different from in the ocean. Yet when people encounter the experiences of the other, they become conscious of a common humanity as they make meaning in their differences. They learn to adapt their thinking. For people who had not experienced it before, hitting a rock and locating a spring was unthinkable. Spending 40 years in the desert and adapting to different conditions prepared the Israelites for transition from life in Egypt to life in Canaan. It was almost as if two generations of memories and traditions needed to fade into memory for the people to adapt to the new circumstances. We are offered a life to drink life-giving water, to adapt to the Jesus way instead of the world's way. We do not get to carry the tank or the bucket to control and possess the water. We get to drink directly from God's own life-giving so that we can be part of the irrigation system to share life in the world. When Jesus died, water and blood came out. The pouring out of the water of life means there is no longer a holding together of the ground in that person. Later, in the ongoing resurrection, the sharing of the body and blood is a sharing of the dam, the cup of life. As we come to share in communion, we see this as a receiving of life, a sharing, a building of life as community, and a call to share life beyond us, beyond our community. We are meant to be present to life itself. In the face of so much sorrow and death in the world, our calling is so important. So I invite you today to recommit yourselves to life flourishing, life in abundance, life shared in God's mission in the world. Amen.